This podcast is brought to you by Sky Arts, proud broadcast sponsor of the Guardian Hay Festival, bringing you the book show at Hay every day at 7 p.m. on Sky Arts One HD with me, Mariella Frostrup. For details, visit sky.com/arts.
I'm Sarah Crown.
And I'm Claire Armistead.
And this is the Guardian's Haycast. We like to think that Hay is a retreat from the world, but with all these politicians and heavyweights around, it sometimes can feel as if the news has followed us here.
Yesterday, for instance, Henning Mankell was due to appear here at Hay, but cancelled to be on the Palestinian aid flotilla headed to Gaza. As we know, it was attacked by the Israelis on its way there.
And another Hay speaker, the human rights barrister Michael Mansfield, was also planning to be on that flotilla, but he decided instead to turn down the invitation to be here at the festival. And when we caught up with him in the green room earlier, he was absolutely outraged.
Questions absolutely have to be asked. Nick Clegg writes to The Guardian last December, in which he says this blockade has to end, and if they don't do it voluntarily, then the international community has to act. Now, I wrote to him about this 3 weeks ago, predicting that this convoy was going to be intercepted illegally in international waters, and that the Royal Navy should be there to protect British citizens, if for no other purpose. Has there been a single word uttered by Nick Clegg? Not a word. The British government knew this was going to happen. The Israeli authorities and the state said they would intercept this flotilla. Nobody lifts a finger.
Nick Clegg will actually be here in Hay at the end of the week, and although Michael Mansfield will have left by then, we'll try to pass on this message to the Deputy Prime Minister.
My message to Nick Clegg is you jolly well do what you set out in your article to The Guardian in December last year, that if Israel, and Egypt for that matter, are unwilling to end the blockade themselves, where effectively it's a form of genocide, that people are dying, they don't have the necessary infrastructure, the water, the electricity and all the rest of it. The message is you must not only speak out vocally, immediately, and obviously decry it, but you've got to take action. You've got to take action against Israel, and you've got to start thinking about economic sanctions, political sanctions have got to be taken by the British government if it means anything.
Michael Mansfield was due to give a talk about his recently published memoirs today, but he decided in the event to dedicate the entire hour to discussing the unfolding Israeli situation.
Actually, international politics has crept into loads of the sessions at the festival, not least the event with the South African Nobel laureate Nadine Gordimer. She, of course, grew up under apartheid and became very active in politics there, and her writing's always been politically charged. She talked to Andy Dixon about Telling Times, a collection of autobiographical writings which is just out.
It was very interesting because I found that it begins in 1950 and into the most troubling and changing time of my life. And I found then I was reading the early work as if it had been written by somebody else.
I was going to ask this because you've said a number of times that you don't want to write an autobiography. But for me, one of the most interesting things about this collection is the fragments of autobiography that you allow into it, the scenes of your childhood, of being in New York for the first time. Were you never tempted to join the dots and put it all together into one big autobiography?
No, my intimate life belongs to me, and I have no desire ever to give it away to anybody else. It belongs to me and the people with whom it was lived, in particularly, of course, the man who was the love of my life. So, and I wouldn't like to offend the other men who were not the love of my life. They might have thought they were.
When you look back at that writer from the 50s, what kind of person do you see?
Somebody who had somehow managed to come out of a very narrow background, both the family one and both, of course, the white world of South Africa, which I moved out of very, very young. And started indeed to have to spend my life not as a white but as a South African with black and white and with moving into what was then known as the black world and finding out it could be done, that it was a natural, perfectly natural move. I was not going to be held back by the laws, so that I was then a natural rebel in many ways.
Do you see a distinction, a difference between the kind of writing that you're most known for, the fiction, and this kind of non-fiction work? Do you operate differently as a writer when you're writing non-fiction or journalism? Or tell me about the difference.
Indeed, it is completely different. The law decides a lot about your private life. It was hardly anything you could do. And if you were white, there were very many things you couldn't do either. And when the change came in South Africa, when we got our freedom, when we all voted for the first time in 94, you could imagine that was like to be standing next in the queue to go and vote with a black man or a black woman. They had never voted before, never could. And here you had lived to see this change come about. Even more striking for me was to go into the park to see a black man and a white woman, or vice versa. I got a shock. I thought they're going to be arrested any minute. They would have gone to prison. So this kind of thing really formed me as a person, and of course influenced the difference between writing from inside and then being stirred to write something factual in order to defend some depredation of the law, which was already changed. But you have got the right to keep these things separate, and I have kept them absolutely separate. I've always written in my fiction, my novels and stories, exactly what came from inside. But I have been stirred by certain events where I have then written something purely factual. Yes, because I've been indignant about it as a human being. It has been a necessity for me to act as a human being in the way that I know how, which is with words.
You've written about how what is expected of a writer can be a threat to them. It can imprison you, people's expectations. What do you think has been expected of you as a writer?
People always say if you get the Nobel Prize, which I did in 91, then journalists say, well, you know, how is this going to affect you? Is she going to write something as well as she did before? The answer is not at all. The only way to deal with it is to completely ignore this. I was fortunate also because I was in the middle of something. I simply went back and finished it.
So looking back, you don't think it changed you, even, and you said this at the time, that you didn't think it would. 20 years ago, it hasn't had any impact at all, or impossible to measure?
No, not at all. It is, of course, the height of any honour that a writer can get. And indeed, you know, for about 3 years before, every time you come up in the list, the people phone you, journalists phone you and say, you're now a third on the list, then you're second on the list, you know, you and so-and-so are neck and neck. What have you got? How do you feel about this? My answer was always, if I get the prize, then I will let you know. Goodbye.
Politics is so tied into your writing and an awareness of politics. Have you ever struggled with the notion that you yourself are a political figure now and that there's expectation placed on you in that sense as a kind of public figure?
I've become a public figure, not through my writing. I believe that I would be the writer that I am, and I certainly would have got whatever recognition, including the Nobel. This has to do with the quality of the writing. But I have realised my responsibility as a human being. And so if you speak out against injustice, you become then a public figure. And indeed, the fact that you have the Nobel Prize gives you an audience perhaps that you wouldn't have had before. But it does give you a fist and a strength if there's a cause that you care about.
We're just a few weeks away from the World Cup arriving in South Africa. What do you think, what effect do you think it will have? Will it be good for South Africa?
That is something that we'll only know in the future. But what I would like to say is let them enjoy it. Why not? Every people needs bread and circuses. And this is the enormous circle of circuses on every field. But there's still a lot of bread missing. We have tremendous tasks ahead of us. Our education is in a bad way. Our schools are underfunded. Our hospitals are also in a bad way at the moment. People need shelter and food. And the circus is a passing thing.
We're in the Guardian shed, as it's been called. We're surrounded by pictures of writers' working spaces, of photographs of desks and books.
Yes.
What kind of space do you write in?
A very small room. I think there's a mistaken idea. I know I've had some writer friends who, the moment that they begin to make money. You know, you want to go and live at, in facing the sea or the mountains and look out on something beautiful. You're not looking out. You're looking into an imaginary context, an imaginary life, imaginary place, imaginary walls around you. You are not there where you're writing at all. So a very simple, humble place. You can. The best thing is you're just writing facing a blank wall with perhaps a few bits and ends of pictures that you like.
I'm Christopher Hitchens, and my guilty reading pleasure is probably the King James translation of the Bible. In fact, today on a book show at Hay, I picked the Book of Job for its language as one of my selections, where the book in which it said the man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward, and also the book in which it is said by Job himself, "Oh, that mine enemy would write a book," a slogan for all who've ever had a bad review.
I'm here in the Guardian Shed with the poet Simon Armitage, who's in Hay to launch his latest collection, Seeing Stars. Hi, Simon.
Hello.
The first thing that I wanted to ask you about was that title. Often the title of a poetry collection gives us a way into the poems themselves and a direction or a call on how to read them. And I wondered what you thought the title of your collection said about the poems that sit inside it.
Well, there is a title poem in there in which somebody receives a very nasty blow on the head, and the seeing stars that he's talking about in that poem are those stars that circle around people's head, you know, when they're suffering from a kind of cartoon concussion, and usually with little canaries as well. I think I suppose it's also a little bit of a reference to celebrity culture. The poems do nominate certain people, and because there's a sort of a sense of celebrity through some of the poems, I think there's a sense of absurdism. But I think it's really the concussion aspect that I'm talking about, because it's quite a wild collection for me, as if I'm off on a bit of a trip or in a bit of a coma, something like that, which I've now come out of, but it was a good trip.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because when I saw the title of your collection before having read any of the poems, I read it as a sort of Yeatsian, you know, heavenly stars, rather than anything to do with concussion at all, so...
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I think, you know, you can make a connection between, you know, poetry and stargazing, and there will be those dreamy kind of stars and the firmament and all that. But this is... I think this is much more of an earthbound collection.
Yeah, one of the first things that is going to strike anyone who opens the collection is the way in which the poems are laid out. And they're very, the layout is very prose-like.
Yeah.
The lines sort of run on, and they take up quite a lot of the page, and they're all very similar in layout. Why did you choose to approach them that way?
Well, I've been writing short-ish lyrical set pieces for the best part of 20 years now.
Because this is quite a change for you.
It is, yeah. It's a real left turn. I just wanted to do something different. You know, I think when you're a writer, you're always, well, when you're a poet, you're always looking for ways to develop and evolve and perhaps impose a bit of a revolution on your voice. And I don't know how these poems came about. I just wrote one or two. I think I was just having fun. Maybe because I translated Sir Gawain and the Green Knight a few years ago, which is full of rules and regulations and technique. And I think I just wanted to get away from any technique, anything that you could point at and say, oh, that is poetic, I sort of wanted to run a mile from. So I just started writing and just let the poems come out, and they didn't really have a form. In fact, I've published some of these poems in magazines in with different layouts, and it was only really when I got to the stage of putting together the proofs that me and my editor sat down and started looking at ways that they would appear on the page. And I suppose what I was after was some kind of... I wanted them to signal some kind of hybrid appearance between poetry and prose. They're not prose poems because I've edited the line endings, and I would still argue that they have that kind of italicized feeling that
so
poetry...
So this is the question. Is it just chopped up prose? Is the question that people are bound to put about it? And so what is it that makes it poetry in your view?
Because I say it is.
Oh.
it's all about context, I think. I think the days when we could do laboratory tests on poems and find out whether they were, you know, they had the correct sort of poetic elements are gone. Every time somebody tries to write some sort of definition of poetry, somebody comes along and writes a poem that disproves that. I would argue that this is a book of poems. It's published by a publisher that's well known for poetry publishing. I tend to be known as a poet. You approach these in that context.
So and poetry is what's written by a poet, then?
Well, it's if it says it's a poem, I think you read it in a particular way. That is the contract. That's the setup. And I think there's a kind of an approach that a reader makes to a poem with that in mind. I would absolutely accept that they don't have that pounds per square inch pressure that I try and build into some of the other more lyrical work. But I would still maintain that the writing here is not information-based, which is what prose tends to be, and that, you know, there are words and phrases that you can look at and accept that they've been chosen for qualities other than just, you know, exposition.
Well, let's let our listeners judge for themselves. You're going to read to us from the collection a poem called Knowing What We Know Now, I think.
I am, yeah. I realised when I'd written it, actually, that I'd always wanted to begin a poem with the line, "The elf said to Kevin." I think subconsciously we all want to write a poem with that line. Okay, Knowing What We Know Now. The elf said to Kevin, "You're probably wondering why I'm sitting here at your breakfast table this morning, helping myself to your condiments. Kevin, I'm here to make you a very special offer. Let's call it a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Today, you're 44 years and 36 days old, and that's exactly how long you've got left. Let me save you the mental arithmetic. You're going to live till you're 88 years and 72 days, and you've just crossed the halfway line. It's what we elves like to call the tipping point. So, Kevin, as of now, you can either carry on regardless and pretend we never met, or say the word, and I can flip the hourglass on its head. Do you see what I'm saying? So instead of getting older, you'll be heading back in the other direction. I've got all the forms. You just sign here, here, and here, and it's goodbye incontinence, hello Ibiza. What do you say, Kevin?" The arthritis in Kevin's shoulder had been bothering him of late, and the prospect of revitalising his tired and aching joints was tantalising, to say the least. Imagine crusading once again through the unconquered landscapes of early manhood, knowing what he knew now. But what about Annie, the woman he loved, the only woman he'd loved in his whole life? Could he really go swanning around with a young man's intentions and a fashionable T-shirt while she slipped away towards undignified infirmity and toothless old age? How cowardly to let her walk death's shadowy footpath alone, thus betraying his every promise to her, thus breaking every vow. And an image formed in his mind, Annie with ghostly hair and faraway eyes, cradling him in her limp, skinny arms, roses in a vase on the bedside table next to the tissues and ventilator, his flawless cheek against her grey cotton gown, his tiny mouth moving hungrily towards her sunken breast. "I won't do it, because of my Annie," said Kevin emphatically. The elf said, "Kevin, you're a gentleman, and God knows there aren't many of them around. And your Annie, she's one in a million." He wiped a few crumbs of crisp bread from the corner of his mouth and added, "No two ways about it. Had the pleasure of breakfasting with her just a few months ago, a stunning, captivating woman, and looking younger every day." Then with a shuffle of his silver slippers on the hardwood floor, he was gone.
Thank you. That was an amazing reading. Thank you very much.
It kind of, I suppose what happens in some of these poems, in my view anyway, is that they harden into poetry, or that, you know, the focus of poetry begins to arrive sometimes in a pointed way in the poem. So there's a line in that poem which says an image formed in his mind, and I think that's for me the section of the poem when poetry starts, you know, crystallizing there amongst the clouds.
And it also has an element of the morality tale about it, this poem in particular, but throughout the collection there is that sense of they're sort of pocket fairy tales, little flights of fancy. And was that something that came as the collection developed, or was that something that you set out with at the beginning?
I like that, pocket fairy tales. Yeah, I think that's exactly what they are. I think sometimes they've got a parable-esque quality about them. Some of them move towards a sting in the tail or a moralistic ending. Others are a bit sort of looser, and some of them are kind of downright weird, really. But you know, it's always the problem with a poem inventing the exit door at the end. I think it was more about the style, actually, though, than, you know, the actual subject matter. Just that the engagement, the communication, the storytelling, and never being absolutely sure where you are as a reader with what's being told to you. I think that's the kind of hazy, you know, sort of position that I want you to be in. And I think that's why they fall somewhere between being, you know, obviously visually poetry and something that sort of visually impersonates something else.
You were a judge of the T.S. Eliot Prize last year. In fact, you chaired the judging panel, no less. And I wondered what you thought the state of British poetry, I know it's a big question, but the state of British poetry, the state we're in today, is because what I've noticed in this year's Hay Festival programme is that for the first year since I've been coming here, there seems to be less poetry on the programme than before. And I wondered why you thought that was.
I would agree with you. I think there is less and less poetry at Hay. And I have found myself quite a sort of lonely figure here, I think, over the last couple of days. There used to be something took place here called the Squantum, which was the kind of, I thought, the heart and soul of the Hay Festival. And what happened was that five or six poets used to come along, and for the whole week they would be writing a poem on a given topic, and they would be doing that in public. And then, you know, finally on the last day they would have to read their finished work. So I would encourage the organisers here to try and get more poets into the festival. And it crossed my mind this morning, there's probably more bodyguards here than poets.
That's a sad state of affairs.
Well, it's just how it is. I think it is known as a kind of publishers' festival here. But, you know, poets, we do good turns. But poetry lends itself to this kind of event in a way that fiction doesn't always. It's, you know, difficult to dive into the middle of a 500-page novel and pick the right bit to read out. But, you know, poetry has a history of presentation and recitation, and, you know, I'm not sure I want to use the word performance necessarily, but just, you know, standing up in front of people and reading and talking. So yeah, I would like to see more of it. I think we should be better represented here.
Okay, Simon Armitage, thanks for coming and making the case for poetry for us.
Nice share.